Trigger warning. This podcast involves discussions of child sexual abuse and pedophilia. Listener discretion is advised. A couple of years ago, something interesting happened. On January 20th, 2018, the Women's March happened. And we could talk about the surrounding flaws of the Women's March all day, but it happened. And in 2018, the Women's March was huge. The reason that was because the Me Too movement was firing on all cylinders, beginning, most argue, with an investigation published in October 2017 detailing the extensive sexual misconduct and, many times, rape committed by Hollywood mogul Harvey Weinstein. The story made a huge impact, both in Weinstein's life, he's in prison now, as well as in our culture. Women were encouraged to share their experiences of abuse, objectification, and there was an outpouring of traumatic stories, some of which resulted in consequences for the perpetrators and others that did not. Most of the cases you probably remember from around this time concerned the wealthy and powerful, but there were also countless examples of women talking about harassment or abuse they had been subjected to in their everyday lives. No matter how you feel about the movement, there's no denying it was huge, and the Women's March in January 2018 reflected that. Natalie Portman, who we discussed in our last episode, spoke at this march, getting specific about how she'd not just been sexually harassed while working in Hollywood, but harassed beginning when she was a child. She says this.
I turned 12 on the set of my first film, The Professional. I was so excited at 13 when the film was released and my work and my art would have a human response. I excitedly opened my first fan mail to read a rape fantasy that a man had written me. A countdown was started on my local radio show to my 18th birthday, euphemistically the date that I would be legal to sleep with. Movie reviewers talked about my budding breasts in reviews. I understood very quickly, even as a 13-year-old, that if I were to express myself sexually, I would feel unsafe, and that men would feel entitled to discuss and objectify my body to my great discomfort. So I quickly adjusted my behavior. I rejected any role that even had a kissing scene and talked about that choice deliberately in interviews. I emphasized how bookish I was and how serious I was, and I cultivated an elegant way of dressing. I built a reputation for basically being prudish, conservative, nerdy, serious, in an attempt to feel that my body was safe and that my voice would be listened to. At 13 years old, the message from our culture was clear to me. I felt the need to cover my body and to inhibit my expression and my work in order to send my own message to the world that I'm someone worthy of safety and respect.
And at the time the speech was given, it was received extremely well. Websites like Refinery29 declared,
"The Women's March wants to change the world. Will we let it?"
BuzzFeed announced,
"Thousands took to the streets for massive women's marches around the world."
Teen Vogue shouted from the rooftops,
"2018 Women's March protesters took to the streets for many different reasons."
So we did it. Feminism wins. Someone tried to make me wear one of those ugly-ass hats, right? Well, the next day, January 21st, all of those websites I just cited posted these headlines.
"Are Millie Bobby Brown and Jacob Sartorius dating or just trolling us?
Fans think Millie Bobby Brown and Jacob Sartorius are dating.
Millie Bobby Brown just insta-confirmed her relationship with Jacob Sartorius and I have butterflies."
You have butterflies? Okay, boomers, Millie Bobby Brown is the star of Netflix's Stranger Things and was only 13 years old at the time these stories are written. And they're speculating that she was dating 15-year-old TikTok star Jacob Sartorius the day after Natalie Portman made that speech.
"I understood very quickly, even as a 13-year-old, that if I were to express myself sexually, I would feel unsafe, and that men would feel entitled to discuss and objectify my body to my great discomfort."
Millie Bobby Brown just insta-confirmed her relationship with Jacob Sartorius and I have butterflies. You guys, and this wasn't even the first time that this had happened to Millie Bobby Brown. When season 2 of Stranger Things came out on Netflix in 2017, the internet was flooded by grown-ass people commenting on how much older she looked, how she's grown up before our eyes.
Movie reviewers talked about my budding breasts in reviews.
This same thing happens to nearly any child growing up in the spotlight. Now, I'm not claiming here that Hollywood-driven feminism is the most important thing in the world. In fact, I find it to be pretty frustrated and over-commercialized and lacking all intersectionality more often than not. But it's on this issue, the treatment of underage performers in particular, that I feel like has been pretty undercovered in the media. Probably because the media was one of the primary forces perpetuating it. And the dissonance of that is demonstrated through this story from just 3 years ago. A story that was published the day after what was supposed to have been the largest feminist reckoning of our lifetimes. The day after. Here's what my friend and yours, Mara Wilson, who played Matilda in 1995 and was in Mrs. Doubtfire, had to say about Millie Bobby Brown's exploitation back in 2017.
Commenting on a child's body, whether in a positive or negative way, in a sexualizing or pitying way, is still commenting on a child's body.
Yeah, and that's coming from someone who has lived it. How many grown actors who endured this level of bodily and personal scrutiny need to bring this up without media forgetting the lesson literally overnight? It's pretty common knowledge what an exceptionally difficult task it's been to get a productive conversation about how we treat children in the media, whether we're talking about Stranger Danger or with working child stars. As always, the type of trial focused on betrays those American prejudices. The focus on able-bodied, upper-class white children are still the stories and stars that receive the most focus. And on top of that, in Hollywood, it's been historically nearly impossible to report on child exploitation, in spite of constant whispers that it takes place at an alarming rate. One of the only documentaries on this subject, Amy Berg's 2011 documentary, An Open Secret, gained millions of views when it was released for free online, since it had never, ever found a formal distributor. Studios with money do not find making these experiences available to a wide audience to be profitable. The ability to address the issue meaningfully is further complicated by the QAnon death cult making escalated claims that literally every powerful person in the world they do not like is a child sex abuser, making it even more difficult to get these stories told responsibly. Make no mistake, QAnon logic, as it pertains to this issue especially, only makes it more difficult for actual child sex abusers to be reported on and punished. So yes, there is a ton of responsibility on the capitalistic structures that exploit child performers and refuse to take a look in the mirror in order to protect those performers. But there's also a great deal of complicity in us, the consuming public. Because yes, it is wrong of media outlets like Refinery29, Teen Vogue, and BuzzFeed to publish these stories. But a major contributing factor to why they publish these stories is because people click on them. Now, I'm not putting teenagers on blast who want to know more about stars their age. I'm talking about weird adults who see the phrase 13-year-old having a boyfriend gives me butterflies and being like, damn, gotta know more about that. And I'll be honest, I've probably been this person at some point. Maybe you have too. It's so normalized in pop culture to overexpose public figures, and I fuck with celebrity gossip and culture. It's fun as hell. But speculating on the love life of a middle schooler is ghoulish. And as Natalie Portman articulated very clearly, this absolutely affects how that middle schooler grows up and perceives themselves and the world. Some of these sites end up realizing the cognitive dissonance of the stories they'd published, particularly Refinery29, and that site vowed to not comment on the bodies or romantic lives of adolescents anymore. Meanwhile, other media outlets criticized the stories having been written in the first place. And guess what phrase they borrow to describe how Millie Bobby Brown was treated?
Hollywood's Lolita complex, still a problematic issue for young female stars.
Time's finally up for Hollywood's Lolita complex.
The phrase Lolita complex has been used at length over the years and has meant slightly different things depending on the year the term is coming up. Here, it's being used as the culture's tendency to over-sexualize teenagers. But in earlier decades, the term was more often applied to assign blame to the teenager, making the Lolita complex something the teenager has, not us. Why is she acting so sexy? We see a lot of elements of this in the 1990s. You might remember that Rolling Stone magazine cover we talked about in episode 6, where Britney Spears is posed in a bra and tiny shorts, holding a Teletubby and talking on the phone. In media of this time, no one asked Rolling Stone or the photographer why Britney had been marketed that way. No, they asked a teenage Britney, Why was she posing like that? And what about the women who played the part that the Lolita complex borrows its name from? Are these women, who are largely underage performers at the time, responsible for how the media frames and exploits them? In 2021, no, of course not. Who in their right fucking mind would do that? But with the four Lolitas we'll be talking about today, they did. Filmmakers, directors, and large systems of power presented these Lolitas to us, but they wouldn't have done it if we, the general public, weren't going to pay for it. So today we are talking about and in conversation with four women who played Lolita. This is Lolita Podcast. Welcome to the penultimate episode of Lolita Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Loftus. Today, a long foreshadowed episode, a close look at the life and careers of the women who have played Lolita on screen and on stage over the years, and how playing the part affected their life, both behind the scenes and through their treatment in the media. We're going to focus on four performers today, the Lolitas of the stage and screen ranging from 1962 to 1997. These women are Sue Lyon, Chris Gilmore, Blanche Baker, and Dominique Swain. So let's start around 1959, talking about one of the adult stars who shaped the original 60s look of Stanley Kubrick's Lolita. There is one thing I want to mention before Sue Lyon's casting in 1960, and it's a piece that appeared in Esquire magazine in 1959 by one of the most famous feminist writers of the 20th century, Simone de Beauvoir. My mouth can't make French. The piece is called Brigitte Bardot and the Lolita Syndrome. And okay, it's not Lolita complex, but in de Beauvoir's definition, it demonstrates pretty clearly what Lolita syndrome meant around the time of the book's publication. She says this of Brigitte Bardot, the bleach blonde French sex icon of the 1950s and 60s.
Her clothes are not fetishes, and when she strips, she is not unveiling a mystery. She is showing her body, neither more nor less, and that body rarely settles into a state of immobility. She walks, she dances, she moves about. Her eroticism is not magical, but aggressive. In the game of love, she is as much a hunter as she is a prey. The male is an object to her, just as she is to him.
So what's being described here is very different than the Lolita syndrome that is applied to Millie Bobby Brown in the 2010s. In the 50s and 60s, invoking Lolita's name indicated the cultural image we're well associated with by this point in the show, that being a sexually appealing, girlish presenting person who is sexually devious and alluring. It's only in the last few years that the Lolita complex has been used to describe the habits of the media and the public applying these stereotypes. And it's with this energy that we take it into the 1960s to talk about our first Lolita, the original Lolita, Sue Lyon, the star of Stanley Kubrick's 1962 adaptation. Later in her life, when the Adrian Lyne adaptation of Lolita was announced in the 90s, Lyon said this.
My destruction as a person dates from that movie. Lolita exposed me to temptations no girl of that age should undergo. I defy any pretty girl who is rocketed to stardom at 14 in a sex nymphet role to stay on a level path thereafter.
Lyon passed in 2019 after her health had been declining for some time, but there is much to discuss about her life. Sue Lyon was born in 1946 in Iowa as the youngest of five, and her father died before her first birthday. She moved around a little with her siblings and now single mother, who worked at a hospital to support the family, and they eventually landed in LA. As a child, Sue modeled for JCPenney and auditioned for parts to help out her family. Her childhood best friend was Michelle Gilliam, later Michelle Phillips, from the legendary 1960s group The Mamas and the Papas. Lyon had one TV appearance in 1959 and went on a number of auditions before landing in a room with Stanley Kubrick in 1960 auditioning for Lolita. Here's how she described that experience during an interview from the 1980s.
I went on an interview to Stanley Kubrick and Jimmy Harris. And usually in Hollywood, when you go on interviews, they say, hello, oh, what's your name? Thank you very much, goodbye. These two said things like, do you date? Where do you go? What do you do? What time do you come home? What does your mother think of that? Where did you buy that dress? They asked me questions that, you know, I would have to answer, that I did answer. And so when I went, they kept me in there for a whole hour. I was 14.
Lyon is said to beat out 800 other girls for the role. She'd heard a little bit of the book at Michelle's house when she was 13, and the girls thought it was very scandalous. Lyon only learned what the full story was about from her mother, who described it like this.
Before I did the screen test, my mother told me the whole story and made it very clear so that I would know what was going on. And she wanted to make sure I didn't have any problems with that. Mother was very protective of my feelings.
Lyon's mother asked their pastor if Sue should take the part, and the pastor said yes. And it's at this point that Sue became the primary breadwinner of the family at only 14. Many forget that Sue Lyon won a Golden Globe for playing Lolita for Most Promising Newcomer, and that she was supposed to have been poised to become an enormous star. As we discussed in our episode on Stanley Kubrick's Lolita, Lyon's history during the production and press tour of this movie, and furthermore, her contract with Stanley Kubrick and James Harris, the movie's director and producer respectively, was not quite this simple. As writer Sarah Weinman confirmed in reporting for Airmail in the fall of 2020, James Harris had taken Sue Lyon's virginity sometime during the production or press tour of the movie. According to Michelle Phillips, Lyon was 14 and Harris 32 at the time it happened, and Lyon was exclusively contracted to Kubrick and Harris for the next 6 years of her career in the style of old school Hollywood. Other sources of Weinman's describe Lyon as closer to 16 when this occurred, but no matter whose word you're taking, she was not the legal age of consent, and James Harris was her employer. While this was not a big news story at the time, Harris's pursuit of his underage star opened her, not him, up to criticism in the gossip media. Here's a column from Dorothy Kilgallen in 1962 that you might remember from a past episode. Lolita virus catching for Sue Lyon? Sue Lyon, the pretty star of Lolita, has bowled over her producer, James B. Harris. Her age is 16, according to her studio, and he's an old man of 33. She prefers the company of mature men, and James may be her cup of tea when she's a little older and decides it's proper to court her. Who is that story putting the blame on? And this piece was published just 2 weeks after Lyon turned 16. It's around this age where Sue Lyon begins to suffer from depression, which led to abusing drugs. Lyon struggled with both mental illness and a lack of an adequate support structure for much of her life. And this, compounded with the Hollywood luxury she had been inducted into, made it difficult for her to capitalize on what was undoubtedly a huge talent. It's also important to note how Sue Lyon's body was promoted and framed by the press in the fallout of the release of Lolita. We talked about the cinematography of the movie before, but as we know, the marketing images for this movie were infinitely more important in terms of the legacy it left. It's these photos, taken by photographer Bert Stern, that live on and framed Sue Lyon for the public. Here are some photos from this shoot. Sue in the front seat of a car in heart-shaped glasses, lips pouted, head tilted back. Sue in the front seat in the glasses and a denim bikini, holding an American flag close to her face. Sue in a denim shirt and sun hat, sleeping in a field of dandelions. In bed, half naked, with a lollipop and a comic book. In a lawn chair with a lollipop and a comic book. A photo taken from the inside of a hotel room. Sue is in the bikini at the window, wearing the heart-shaped glasses and looking right at the photographer. Pantsless in a phone booth, applying lip gloss and talking on the phone. And the photo you know already, Sue in the heart-shaped glasses, sucking on a lollipop, looking right at you. And here's a sampling of how she was discussed on magazine covers at age 15. Lolita in the flesh. I taught my child to act Lolita. Sue Lyon's mother talks. I'm not Lolita, actress Sue Lyon hopes people know she doesn't live her part. Sue Lyon, so I'm young. Is that a crime?
And egregiously, on the cover of Cosmopolitan, Lolita, Sue Lyon portrays the most controversial girl ever to hit the screen, right next to the headline, "Fasting, easier than dieting." The story of Sue Lyon is a complicated one, but this is indisputable. She was presented while a minor as a sex object for the taking. In 1963, Sue Lyon got married for the first time at age 17 to Hampton Fancher, a writer 8 years her senior who was a well-known man about town at the time, dating starlets like Barbara Hershey before marrying Sue. He was working as an actor at the time of the marriage, but he's best known now as the co-writer of Blade Runner and Blade Runner 2049. When asked by The New Yorker about the marriage in 2017, Fancher had this to say.
There was a lot of bad press. They accused me of being a pompous, horn dog guy interested only in the world of yachts and private jets, which I thought was totally unfair. But they were mostly right. There were bets in Vegas about how long the marriage would last.
Around 9 months, as Fancher tells it, which overlaps with Lyon's second film, John Huston's The Night of the Iguana. It's one of Lyon's more famous roles, and intersecting with later Lolita history, The Night of the Iguana is a Tennessee Williams movie adaptation where Sue Lyon plays a bleach blonde, sexy teen who attempts to seduce an actor over 20 years her senior, in this case, Richard Burton.
I can talk to you. Like I'd never dream of going swimming with Reverend Hotchkiss back home. I mean, he's old.
Lyon had a difficult time with the press in what seemed like never-ending press tours for movies like Lolita and Night of the Iguana. As far as Lolita goes, she was still promoting the movie 2 years after it was released. Not to mention that following her divorce from Fancher, Lyon was briefly linked again to James Harris, who casually said this to a reporter in late 1964.
Oh, we're not getting married, if that's what you mean, but we're very good friends.
Okay. And it's around this time that Lyon loses her older brother to a drug overdose and reaches a breaking point in terms of how she was treated both in the press and within her Hollywood contract. She says this in the 80s.
I think initially, before they knew me, they felt that they were going to build a star. And in the fashion of the old studios, create an image and it would go on for there. But after they realized that and understood my motivation for doing the film, and also I pointed out to them, I said, you know, you've made a tremendous amount of money off of me, and I think you owe me the respect to be who I am. And now I need to get on with the rest of my life. I'll be happy to work again, but not every second. I don't like people, strangers asking me questions. I like to be left alone, really. I was once on a television show, a talk show. My brother had just died 2 days before that. The interviewer opens his show by saying, and now I was 16 years old, he said, did your brother kill himself because you played Lolita? I didn't say a thing. I got up and I walked off and I couldn't even dignify that with, you know, don't you have good sense, sir? I had no words. I left that, and that's typical of the reason that I can't be a movie star. I never could.
Lyon continued in movies throughout the 1960s, appearing alongside many big stars of the time. She was in a John Ford movie, and she was in a Frank Sinatra noir film in which Lyon appears unconscious in a bra and panties on the poster. Also, her face is barely visible. She's not even facing the camera. Also, fuck Frank Sinatra. In the late 80s, Lyon begins to work in TV and TV movies. She spent some time campaigning for Democratic Senator Eugene McCarthy during his bid for the presidency in 1968, and she gives away her New York penthouse to people in need. In 1971, she married photographer and former NFL player Roland Harrison. Their interracial marriage sparked outrage in the U.S., and they moved to Spain as expatriates to live comfortably. This marriage ended by 1972, and it gives Sue Lyon her only child, Nona Harrison. Roland Harrison wasn't in the picture when Nona was a child, and so Sue Lyon raises Nona on her own while struggling with mental illness. They go back to the U.S., where Sue infamously married Cotton Adamson, who was incarcerated in a Colorado state prison for robbery and second-degree murder when they married in 1973. They met when Sue was working as a volunteer in the public defender's office. Not only did this marriage negatively impact Lyon's career and bring on a wave of unwelcome press attention, but Adamson then escaped prison, committed another robbery, and got arrested again before she divorced him in 1975. Lyon considered this the death knell of her acting career, and after a few more TV roles and small films, she completely retired from Hollywood by 1980. It's said that her mental health continued to worsen, and she had a failed fourth marriage before marrying Richard Rudman, a radio engineer, in 1975, who would later say he'd been something of an enabler in Sue's life. And from here, I'd like to let Sue's daughter, Nona, take over. Nona Harrison Gomez still lives in the LA area and runs a company with her husband painting murals, and she's written extensively in blog posts over the years about her very complicated relationship with her mother, up until and after Sue Lyon's death in 2019. It's through Nona's writings that Sue Lyon's extensive struggles with mental illness come into sharp focus. Here is how Nona describes the overview of her early life on her website.
Born and raised in Los Angeles, Nona's life began as a fairy tale. She was the daughter of a famous actress, Sue Lyon, known for Lolita, and NFL player, Roland Harris. Her father was absent for most of her childhood, and being a biracial child, she had questions at a very early age about why she looked so different. By age 12, Sue remarried, and her relationship with her mother was never the same. Nona was kicked out of her house, and by the age of 13, she was taken to a halfway house. That same year, her mother placed her in an insane asylum, where she stayed for almost 3 months. That kind of betrayal by her mother, a woman she once idolized, broke Nona's spirit in a way which would take years to recover from.
Nona has written about her struggles with her mother over the years and the ebb and flow of her mother coming into and out of her life while battling a lifelong struggle with mental illness, all the way up until her death. Here's a passage Nona wrote in March 2018.
For never leaving LA, she's been able to hide away from the Hollywood monsters, and I wouldn't want it any other way. It is the biggest reason it's taken me this long to finish. Protecting her is in my DNA, no matter how much she might have hurt me in the past.
And this passage from July 2018.
We are better strangers than we are family, and that's okay. Every once in a while on my blog posts, I will have someone comment about how they wish my mother and I would be together again. And I thank them for the love they have in their hearts to think if she sees me, she would somehow be different. Yet unhealthy people do not get better, not without a lot of work that they must choose to do. If they stay unhealthy and become older, all they do is become worse and more damaging.
Nona writes about how being separate from her mother was the only way it could be, but still remembers Sue Lyon with a great deal of empathy, acknowledging what a large role her mother's mental illness had in keeping them separate. She still writes about her mother on Sue Lyon's birthday and on the anniversary of her death, expressing a wish that her mom is in peace. I think the way that Nona has kept this legacy is really beautiful, and I'll link to her work in the description. She's doing really great work around social justice as well that I'm excited to share. I'll add here for clarity that after the abuse that she was subjected to as a child, Nona was certainly not under any obligation to make amends or forgive the behavior of an abusive parent, and her blog details her lifetime of navigating that trauma, and as she healed and moved forward with her life as an adult and an independent person, decided on what her boundaries would be. I don't have to tell you that this is a very individual kind of journey. There is no right or wrong way to navigate trauma, particularly childhood trauma, and it's a journey that Nona has chronicled very honestly. She also did this really cool transformative social media campaign in 2018 and 2019 where people would submit pictures of themselves wearing those trademarked Sue Lyon heart-shaped sunglasses while doing something that made them feel like their most authentic self. So a campaign basically to honor her mom's most iconic role. It's one of the coolest transformative uses of the heart-shaped glasses I've ever seen. It was really cool. Sue Lyon passed away in a North Hollywood assisted living facility the day after Christmas in 2019. She survived by friends and her daughter Nona. She was not remembered in the in memoriam reel at the 2020 Oscars, less than 2 months after she died. Some fucking thanks. Our next Lolita is a girl of the 1970s. At the time, she went by Annette Farah. Now she's known as Chris Gilmore. Gilmore was chosen out of allegedly thousands of aspiring auditionees to play the title role in Alan J. Lerner and John Barry's Broadway would-be spectacular Lolita, My Love in 1971. You know, the one that did this?
Who is that viper who likes them post-diaper?
I got to speak with Chris in our episode on stage adaptations of Lolita, but there's a lot more to her story that I think ties into the Lolita legacy. These days, Gilmore is a producer of indie films, most recently a slasher movie called Blood Pageant, starring Beverly Mitchell and Snoop Dogg, that comes out this year. She and her son collaborate often, and when I did the interview, he went down to their garage to get the original poster of Lolita, My Love, that has Chris Gilmore's image on it, to get ready for our talk. It was really sweet. Now, records of Gilmore's performance as Lolita in the show unfortunately don't exist. She was replaced in the show, for reasons we will be recapping here, by Denise Nickerson, who played Violet Beauregard in Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory the same year. But Gilmore's life before Lolita was just as fascinating. Traumatizing as her personal experience as Lerner's Lolita was, at 14, she was already no stranger to the ways that the entertainment industry was willing to over-sexualize someone underage, because she was a child of Hollywood, with a mother who was a dancer and a father who ran late-night clubs with musical acts. Her sister, Sandy Farah, later famously dated Elvis Presley. Chris's first appearance on screen was when she was only 6 years old on the Alfred Hitchcock Hour.
She's probably a secret agent or something, see? And she's supposed to steal the plans for Daddy's secret rocket.
Other small roles followed, including an appearance on The Brady Bunch, but her real passion was music. I'll let her describe the kind of environment she grew up in.
Well, I will tell you, I am a big Alan J. Lerner fan. Growing up, I was a poet laureate in school, and I loved writing. You know, I loved rhyming. So I really loved him, and I was so jazzed to work for him. However, he wrote, I guess, I don't know if your listeners will know this, but he wrote My Fair Lady,
yes,
which, you know, gave Audrey Hepburn her big break. And I knew my acting and I knew my singing. I wasn't a very good dancer. My sister was an incredible dancer, but I kind of faked it through, because everything in those days, still, you had to sing and dance. But I was discovered in my dad's club. Every Monday night, everybody was discovered. I mean, the Righteous Brothers got their break. Sonny and Cher got their break. Back in the day, he had 7 clubs, but the one that was the most famous was called the Red Velvet. I was offered a record career, first with Mercury Records back then, and then with 4-Star. And then Mike Curb heard me sing, and he was working on the Osmond Brothers. It was about the time the Osmond Brothers and the Jackson 5 were really jamming.
By 15, Gilmore was in the recording business with a record contract. This is a great opportunity to play you a song she sang as a tween again, as it is now my personal anthem, You're a Dum Dum.
If you mistreat me, baby, you're a dum dum.
So Gilmore's true ambition lay in music. Acting, being a connected teen in the industry, was more of a means to an end for her. And this made the announcement of auditions for Lolita, My Love pretty goddamn exciting. This was a chance for her to make her Broadway debut in a leading role, in a show by one of the most famous lyricists of his generation. Remember, Lerner's the guy who did goddamn My Fair Lady, Gigi, Camelot. The clout was a near certainty. Here's how Gilmore describes the auditions.
You're going to laugh at this. Really laugh at this, but I turned down any role that I thought was risque, right? And he says, you have an audition for a show called Lolita. And I went on 7 auditions. And I don't know how I got into that. I didn't read the book like you. I didn't know. I just knew, you know, Alan J. Lerner. Yay.
Sure.
And the songs were kind of, you know, vague. So I thought, okay. And it's a comedy, musical comedy. They have been looking on the East Coast and the West Coast for someone to be Lolita. And they picked me and contracted me, but I wasn't allowed to say anything. Okay. And they kept the ads out that they were looking, because they were keeping the publicity going.
I'll also refer you back to a Vulture piece from 2018 by Sarah Weinman, who I've interviewed on the show, where she talks about the auditions for Lolita, My Love. Young actresses arrived with their mothers, usually, saying that they, quote, wouldn't like to be Lolita, but would like to play the part, unquote. You might remember this description of what an audition for that show was like. Quote, "Don't wear makeup next time," said one of the producers to an auditioner. "I want it to look sexy," they replied. "You look sexy anyways," he said, unquote. So yeah, there's a lot of similarities to what we hear described in Sue Lyon's description of Kubrick auditions. And I want to be clear, this audition culture was not a phenomenon exclusive to the part of Lolita. It was completely cooked into the auditioning process for girls and women, both underage and adult. Whether we're talking about the casting of Scarlett O'Hara in the 1930s or casting Ariel in a Disney live-action reboot in the 2010s. But Chris Gilmore gets the part and takes a big risk by dropping her record deal in order to do so, then going to New York with her sister to begin rehearsals on Lolita, My Love. We discuss a lot of her onset experiences in our episode of Lolita stage adaptations, but I want to remind you the reason she is ultimately asked to leave the production after months of script changes and behind-the-scenes mess. And keep in mind, up until about a month ago, the only media narrative available about Gilmore's leaving the production was that she was not good enough to play the part, which was definitely not the case.
Mr. Lerner said, you know, we have to make it more risque. Mm. And, you know, because I'm jumping ahead, though. I go, what's the snaps in the top of my nightgown? Mm-hmm. What the heck is this? What did they do to it? And nobody wanted to tell me. And this is a hell of a way to hit it on an actress. But, you know, I went around and then somebody said, well, Mr. Lerner will come in. And so he told me, well, the snaps are in the top because you're going to drop your nightgown. You're going to rip it off and drop it in that scene. You know, I was singing for this is the problem in this world. You know, I trained method, Meisner, comedy, improv. I had it all. I sang. And so I refused, and then I'll never forget the producer's last words. He said, well, you're too virtuous.
So the choice is given to a 15-year-old that either she takes her clothes off on a Broadway stage every night, regardless of how comfortable she feels, or she doesn't get to be on Broadway. They'll find a girl who will do it. And by all accounts, that's exactly what happened. This, of course, was devastating to Gilmore. She had become close with Alan J. Lerner, was performing well in rehearsals and rolling with the script changes, and this was going to be her big break. But once she wasn't willing to play ball, Lerner dropped her. Gilmore describes the fallout of that experience.
But then when we came back to California, I heard that my understudy, she offered to do whatever they needed to do. Mm-hmm. And she was an amazing girl. She played the blueberry.
Yeah.
In Willy Wonka. Yeah. And, you know, I had a lot of respect for Denise, but I couldn't understand why she accepted to do that. And so they opened and brought on Broadway, tried it out. And then I got a call just a few days later and through my agent, and my agent called us and said, they want you back. And I did my best, and like I said, Jamie, I'm a big advocate for women's rights and men's rights to not be sexually harassed.
Yeah.
Every person, you know, nobody should be sexually harassed or asked to do something in the entertainment industry that is they're not comfortable doing. I don't know what the hell it was. But I was a very innocent young woman, but I was sexually harassed so much by so many producers. I could tell you names. You go, really? And writers and never by the actors. Amazing. The actors were always amazing and we always got along great. But it was producers. It was directors. It was writers. And not only offered roles. And I'm not saying I was sexually harassed in Lolita because I wasn't. I was offered or I was told I was going to strip. And that was a different thing. But still, to me, it's infringing on a sexual harassment. You
absolutely.
Know?
Yeah.
So
especially
you know,
as a minor. That's absurd. Oh, that's ridiculous.
And, you know, I this is the irony. Okay, Jamie, you can get this. I come from this, you know, this uptight family. You can't date. I don't care how hot that kid is and he's starring on a series. You can't have coffee with him. It's wrong, you know. Yet All right. They were okay with it. I mean, my father literally said, well, why don't you just, it's a body stocking. What's wrong with that? Wow. And it's like, Daddy, you threw Davy Jones out of our club because he wanted to take me out. And, you know, and here you are telling me, you're telling me that it's okay with you if I stand in front of hundreds of people and they see everything, you know,
right.
That's okay with you. Mm. But, you know, if it hadn't had the subject matter it had, if it had been straight comedy, maybe I would have gone back. You know, I didn't talk to Mr. Lerner. I was very upset with what they did.
Yeah.
Because Johnny Carson wanted me on The Tonight Show to talk about what they offered me and why I quit. And they squashed that interview. But when they squashed and canceled all of the things, and even The Tonight Show, that did it for me.
Right.
You know, I mean, my God, I was angry with them. I was very disappointed that Mr. Lerner and their whatever powers that be in that play would stop me from telling what really happened.
Mm.
Because I saw some write-ups, I saw some things that weren't what really happened.
She then returned to L.A. with less than what she started with. Having sacrificed her record contract to take the part of Lolita, she was about to turn 16 and was back at square one. She tried to get back into acting, only to be faced with more misogyny and more setbacks.
And I was a little flashy, you know. I think that's why I kept getting sexually harassed all my life, because I, you know, I had very big breasts. And I couldn't help it. That's how God made me, you know. And I was very curvaceous. And you know, it's not that I, you know, wore like really risque clothing or that I came on to anybody with that like that look, you know, hey, baby, you know. But you know, I was very innocent. But it was just the look, right? So that look got in my way. And Sissy, God bless her, she did a great job with that role. So, you know, nobody could do better than her. So, you know, I lost it. But then Ross called me back and said, I have another role. I want you in this film. And they loved your performance. So would you take this other role? And it was actually the role that John Travolta was in, very small role, where the girl's giving him head in the car and then she bites his you-know-what off.
So after a while, Chris Gilmore decides it's time to switch gears. And she begins working in a profession where she feels she might be less judged, as well as to help prevent some of her own traumatic casting experiences. Chris Gilmore gets into casting herself. But again, she's met with a lot of gendered resistance.
That flashy rock look I had and the youth and the big breast, you know, it still followed me everywhere I went. So people didn't always have it easy to take me seriously as a casting director or as a businesswoman, but I was always a nerd at heart, you know. I was the poet laureate. I was like Alan J. Lerner. I get the big rhyming books and try to make quadruple rhymes, and I love language, you know. The way my parents raised me is you help each other.
Yeah, absolutely.
The most disappointing thing that I've had in my life is the predators that have sexually harassed me rather than help me when I was giving them my talent, whether it was casting-wise, writing-wise, or acting, you know, making me run around a conference table, chasing me, and then taking my name off of the guard gate of Warner Brothers because I ran out of the room. What about what I can give you? I'm giving you casting and writing. Why aren't you giving me some humanity and respect and kindness? Yes. I had stopped writing and casting, and I'm going to cry over this one because the world disappoints me.
But still, after pivoting her career, Gilmore is also mistreated as a casting director. So she becomes disillusioned and starts her own production company, where she can be her own boss, and she produces films today. Gilmore hasn't discussed Lolita, My Love publicly, and I'm grateful she was willing to speak with me. She has overcome a ton of odds in her career and still reflects on her treatment during Lolita, My Love as a betrayal she experienced while still a kid by the composer, by the industry, and by the media.
Nobody wanted anybody to know I quit the show.
Right.
Nobody wanted anybody to know that they asked me to strip and that it wasn't in my contract. And I would guess that they would squash that information and being as strong and having, you know, as much power as they did in the industry, I really don't think that the word got out there what really happened. I do know that I was squashed. Like I told you, I wanted to be on The Tonight Show. That would have been so cool.
Of course,
I could actually tell you I was with Johnny Carson. How iconic would that be? But no, you know, so I would think that all of the information out there doesn't tell anybody. I don't know if you even read that they begged me back. They offered me a lot more money. They wanted me back. They said that it was that it failed without me, and that they wanted me enough to be there, you know, without the nudity.
Right.
But you know, but I don't know if that's even there, nor did I care.
So Chris Gilmore survives Lolita, yes. But like Sue Lyon, her mistreatment behind the scenes and in the media end up leading her to leaving acting altogether. I want to thank her again for speaking with me, and go see Blood Pageant this year, goddammit. I also want to mention a little bit about the actor who replaced Gilmore. Denise Nickerson, as you may remember from earlier episodes, played the role of Lolita in Lolita My Love for even less time than Chris Gilmore, really just long enough for the show to flop in Boston one last time. Fortunately, her existing resume as a child actor in Dark Shadows and as Violet in Willy Wonka, as well as previous Broadway appearances, were enough to hide the stain of Lolita My Love's failure. Nickerson had it with Hollywood by the time she was 21, and she announced that she was retiring, only to realize that her parents had squandered every cent she'd ever made. For the rest of her life, she worked as a receptionist and an office manager, and went to conventions for Dark Shadows and Willy Wonka to make ends meet. She is said to have remained extremely optimistic and good-natured by all accounts, and she passed away in Aurora, Colorado in 2019 after a long illness. She was friends with the actors who played Veruca Salt and Mike TV all the way up until her death. Here's what Nickerson said in a 2010 interview.
I had always wanted to be an attorney. However, because there were no Jackie Coogan laws in New York, my parents had spent all of my money, and it was a lot. In a slow year like 1966, I made $46,000, but all of my money was gone and my hopes of being an attorney were dashed. So I'm 21 with no money to go to college. I know I need to get a job. Back then, you didn't need a college degree to get a position. It's much harder today. But I realized that if I started at the bottom and learned through, quote, on-the-job training, I might be able to make it. I had decided I didn't want to act anymore, so the first thing I did was go cut my hair, and my agent just lost his mind, as did my mother. But I went ahead and got a job. I've really had two very different lives. I had that life, and now I have this life, and I'm very blessed. I've seen both sides of the coin.
Are two Lolitas of the 1970s. Like Sue Lyon, they both retire from the business while still in their 20s. So let's keep it moving. Let's get into the 80s and to our third Lolita, the star of the inexplicable second Broadway adaptation of Nabokov's Lolita by Edward Albee, Blanche Baker. We also aired part of an interview I did with Baker in our episode on stage adaptations, but I'm excited to get into her career a little more, because she is the only actor who played Lolita in a major Nabokov-blessed adaptation who did so as an adult. And the ways that her story deviates from that of Lyon's and Gilmore's, I think, are very interesting. Blanche Baker appears at a very interesting intersection of two generations of Lolita imagery. We discussed the details of the Edward Albee 1981 production at length in episode 5, and so I won't rehash it too heavily here, but there's a lot about Blanche Baker's background that makes her unique in this saga. Blanche Baker's mother, you're going to love this, played one of the roles that is considered to be the visual inspiration and stencil for how Sue Lyon was presented in Stanley Kubrick's Lolita. So if you will, a brief sidebar for Blanche Baker's mother, actor Carol Baker. Carol was born in 1931 to a poor family and worked her way up to study with famed acting coach Lee Strasberg at the Actors Studio in New York in the 1950s. Here she studies alongside the likes of Mike Nichols, Marilyn Monroe, future Kubrick Lolita alumni Shelley Winters. Carol Baker studies method acting. She's a serious fucking actor that really gets into the role. and she works in commercials for a bit before starting to get roles on Broadway in her early 20s. She was then cast by Elia Kazan, who had already famously collaborated with Tennessee Williams in A Streetcar Named Desire, to play Baby Doll, a part originally intended and styled very similarly to Marilyn Monroe. And Baker becomes very famous for playing the titular character in Baby Doll, who, like Sue Lyon in Night of the Iguana, is a character in a Tennessee Williams play that is a sexy young seductress. A quick note here. Although Sue Lyon and Carol Baker both played these naive ingenue roles adapted from Tennessee Williams' texts here, I'm not trying to push the narrative that Tennessee Williams' work was inherently sexist. By all accounts and judging from what I've seen of it, he wrote complicated female characters on a pretty regular basis. And while people have valid opinions on patterns in his female characters, his female parts were very well regarded in their time. And there's certainly no denying that he was not an advocate of the stereotypical Hollywood beauty embodied by Lyon or Carol Baker. Baker says in a 2019 interview that Tennessee Williams was advocating for a fat actress in the role of Baby Doll, but the studios would not allow it. I'll link some more information to Tennessee Williams' life in the description. The movie goes like this. Baby Doll Megan, as she is known, is a very naive 19-year-old who marries a poor alcoholic in the Mississippi Delta who she refuses to sleep with until she turns 20. In the meantime, she sleeps in a crib in the living room, and as the plot goes, her sexually frustrated husband gets more and more frustrated as his crib-sleeping wife flirts with other men.
You're a child, Miss Min. That's why we played the game of hide-and-seek. It's a game for children.
Well, you don't have to go all the way home to take a nap. You could take a nap here. It's gonna rain anyhow. There's a small bed in there. A crib? Curl up and let the slats down.
It sounds weird because it is weird, but there's two things to note. First of all, Carol Baker is fantastic as Baby Doll, maybe too fantastic. But the second thing I want to tell you is that this movie was a lot more talked about for its marketing of Carol Baker than about her actual performance. Here's what I mean. Just before the movie's release, Warner Brothers approved a 135-foot-high billboard of Carol Baker in the promotional image for Baby Doll, which was, I shit you not, an image of a scantily clad Baker laying in a crib and sucking her thumb. This got a lot of attention, earning the movie a number of bans for indecency before its release because of how Baby Doll is styled and presented in the marketing, similar to what happens to both movie adaptations of Lolita. This scandal turns Baker's image into an icon, and while she received incredible reviews in this movie, the press mainly focused on her body. Another through line here, Carol Baker wins the Golden Globe for Most Promising Newcomer for this role, much like Sue Lyon does later for Lolita. Baker struggled within the studio system at Warner Brothers and ends up buying out her contract there, and turns out great performances all throughout her 20s. Though most of these lacked the high-profile glamour of Baby Doll. In her 30s, film producer Joseph E. Levine gloms onto the actress and pushes Baker to remarket herself as a bombshell again. She appeared naked in Playboy in 1964 and started taking on very blonde, very glamorous roles like a lukewarm-received Jean Harlow biopic. Baker was not happy with these roles or this styling, and wasn't shy about saying how controlling and possessive Levine was to her during this time. She gets out of her contract with him and Paramount, and later says this in the 1970s.
I was under contract to Joe Levine, who was going around giving me diamonds and behaving like he owned me. I never slept with him or anything, but everybody thought I was his mistress.
And Levine is very powerful in Hollywood, so Baker speaking out against how he was treating her essentially results in her getting blacklisted from the industry. So Carol Baker, in spite of being Brando-level talented, has been kicked around in controlling contracts and sexed up time and time again. So she says fuck it. She divorces her husband and she takes her kids to Italy and begins working in the Italian film industry with some more freedom. It's there that she becomes a scream queen in Italian movies, slowly bailing herself out of Hollywood debt and becoming famous abroad for playing frequently murdered women who spoke Italian. Back in the U.S., she was teased for becoming the queen of Italian exploitation movies, but for Carol Baker, for the first time, she had freedom and an income that she controlled, and this period in her career gave her a lot of confidence. Feeling better about herself, she moves her family back to the U.S. in the 70s, returns to the stage, and becomes a character actor in the 80s and 90s. Then she pivots again and becomes an author, and she's still publishing books now. She rocks. But without doubt, the role that shaped Carol Baker's career and the moment that changed how the world perceived her was that 135-foot billboard in Times Square. That dictated how the press treated her, how the public treated her, and how men within her own industry would be allowed to treat her. So much so that she had to leave the country to continue in the profession she was extremely gifted in. So that's Carol Baker. And her daughter is actor Blanche Baker, who was born in late 1956 and spends her childhood watching her mother act in Italy. Blanche goes on to also study Strasbourg in New York, and her career gained momentum quickly. She won an Emmy in 1979 at only 22, started racking up roles on TV and in film, and so when the opportunity came to play Lolita in an Edward Albee play, she couldn't say no. What sets her apart here is that she's 24 when this happens. But the situation Blanche finds herself in echoes the role that ends up overblowing her mother's bombshell image. They were both talented and well-trained actors. They both got the opportunity to play the title role in a work from the most famous playwright of their respective eras, Tennessee Williams for Carol Baker and Edward Albee for Blanche Baker. These roles are, by all accounts, played extremely well by them, but the inherent scandal of the production and the way that they're styled ends up overshadowing their work and interfering with their lives. This irony is not lost on Blanche Baker, and she was kind enough to speak with me about her experience in Albee's 1981 Lolita, which closed in the blink of an eye on Broadway. Blanche Baker's Humbert, by the way, was Donald Sutherland. Here's a little of our talk.
In Boston, there were protests, and for some reason, I know I looked young, and there was some idea that I was really a teenager playing this role, and I used to have to cross picket lines to get into the theater, starting in Boston. And to his credit, one of the reasons I believe I stayed in touch with Jerry, who passed away recently, but I'll never forget him walking me across the picket lines in New York. He knew that it was difficult if I had to do this to get to my dressing room. Now, we didn't run for that long. We managed to get the poster up in Sardi's for shows that close quickly. Right. But for, I think it was 2 weeks or so in New York, and he mm-hmm. would always, he walked me in. And I thought that was just a lovely gesture. Those days, IMDb didn't post everybody's ages.
That's true.
All the roles I played, I was playing 12 all the time. So I guess, really seriously,
yeah.
I spent most of my early roles with like a bandage wrapped around my chest. And I did the same thing I had done, The Seduction of Joe Tynan. Mm-hmm. And I was playing Alan Alda's, daughter. I was also playing 12. So it was just a thing I did. Even in Holocaust, she ages in that too. But I start off playing like 9 or something.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
What is that experience like being asked to kind of play so much younger for so long? Was it fun?
You're just so happy that you get an opportunity to work. You're like, I tell that to my students all the time. Gee, that door opens a crack. You've got to go barreling through it.
Mm-hmm.
And then it changes throughout your life. Believe me, I am not playing 12 anymore. So you have to adjust,
Sure.
And but at the time, that's sort of what I was doing. And so there was some mistake about, that I was still 12, even though I'd been 12 for maybe 10 years.
I want to mention here the phenomenon that Blanche is describing. While it's great that actors are getting work, and it's very much a job where you need to seize the opportunities you're given, this falls neatly into a trend that still persists now and relates directly to Lolita adaptations. And I'm talking about the tendency to cast people in their 20s or older to represent teenagers or younger,
So think Riverdale, think Grease, think really any TV show about teenagers. This isn't a slight to the actors at all, but this trend does condition us to think that underage characters look much more mature than they would in real life. As this pertains to Lolita, most adaptations age Dolores Hayes up from 12 to 14 at least, then cast an actress slightly older than that to play her, then style her to look older than that. And in many ways, that makes sense because putting an actual 12-year-old on stage in that role is extremely dangerous. But this instinct and trend shouldn't be ignored and is something I'm going to touch on in our last episode as well. I always think of the movie Eighth Grade here, where seeing an actor who is 13 playing a 13-year-old character can be very jarring for audience members, since we're just not used to pop culture realistically reflecting what a child of that age actually looks and sounds like. With Lolita especially, this creates a very complicated catch-22. This discussion is an absolute rabbit hole, and while I feel it is obviously safer and more ethical to cast an actor of Blanche Baker's age playing younger, I have to ask myself, what does this normalize for an audience member if we believe that she is 14? What does that normalize for an audience member who is 14? On top of that, that's not to say that being an adult at the time of playing Lolita exempt Baker from severe press harassment. It absolutely did not. Here's a little more of our interview. I was going to ask about your mom as well, of what had you kind of taken away from her experience to be able to bring in, you know, experiences like these where you're being pushed back against for reasons that have nothing to do with you.
She was the unhappiest at the height of her career. Mm-hmm. So I was wary of it, and I fell into some of the traps of it. Mm-hmm. So if you're swayed by what everybody says and everybody thinks, it's going to be tough. I did take a step back eventually from the business, and, you know, now much happier teaching and, you know, working when I do work with a different point of view.
Yeah. So, and this was kind of around the time of Lolita that you were kind of navigating that and figuring that out?
Yeah, because I was thrust in the spotlight, you know. Mm-hmm. Even when I didn't give permission for things, I remember they put a picture from the show in Playboy magazine after I had turned down an interview. So it was like, wait a second.
No kidding.
Yeah, very small. Yeah. And then, you know, I just wanted to be taken seriously. I know there's a lot of, there are some press photos and I was in a slip and stuff like that, but that was not actually part of it. Oh, and I was in a bathrobe and I brought the bathrobe at some point, but the audience just saw my back.
So in the press photos that have the slip, that wasn't actually on, that didn't end up being on stage?
No.
Interesting. From what I've seen, the show ran for a couple of weeks after Boston previews. What was that switch from Boston to New York like?
That was the onslaught of publicity. So that was very difficult. You know, and I had to be very careful. I was a young girl. I didn't have a lot of money and stuff. And I was being followed after the show and stuff. And I had to have people meet me. I remember it was really not so pleasant, that aspect. Once I was, before I got on the stage and after I got off the stage, it really wasn't a heck of a lot of fun. I remember having to go to the police department with some guy who was like following me. And some guy was leaving, had followed me and left things at my apartment building. And oh yeah, I moved. And oh yes, it was all sorts of crazy stuff. I feel like anytime I went to a party, people were really looking at me, so I stopped going to parties. I really became more of a recluse than you would imagine. Sure. Because I felt like I couldn't live up to what people expected. That was my own insanity, I guess. Mm-hmm. But I felt like they would expect me to be prettier, expect me to be, you know, sexier, forget that I was an actress. And I was just very uncomfortable for a while in my own skin.
It's worth mentioning, Blanche Baker was said to have been amazing in this play. And that's saying a lot because Lolita is not given much in the way of substance to do by Albee. The New York Times said, quote, "The critics were almost unanimous on one point. Blanche Baker was an ingenue whose time had come," unquote. before the show was abruptly shut down. And it's interesting because when I read the details of the protesters to this production and where they were coming from, they were women who felt that the play was attempting to make light of child sex abuse. And I'm inclined to agree with that, but I don't see how making a young female star feel unsafe helps to prove that point. Also, hilariously, the protest group was called Women Against Pornography, or WAP. It just feels good to laugh. So Lolita does end up nearly forcing Blanche Baker out of the business, out of sheer anxiety and frustration with the press. Where she benefits, of course, is by growing up witnessing her mother go through very similar experiences. So Blanche bounces back.
Yeah, I think I was very lucky because I did some theater. I did Poor Little Lambs and Paul Rebney play. And then, you know, I did 16 Candles, which became sort of a cult classic. And here we are all these years later. Yeah. And, you know, I'm full-time faculty at the New York Film Academy, and teaching brings me great happiness. In the end, I feel like I had much more positive to take from it and was able to overcome that tsunami of press and fighting and all sorts of silly things that shouldn't really detract from the art.
So that's Blanche Baker, and she's our Lolita of the 1980s. Which brings us to the fourth Lolita, the last prominent one in pop culture canon, Dominique Swain, who played Lolita in the 1997 Adrian Lyne movie adaptation. I've been trying for months to get a hold of Dominique to speak on this show, and it was not to be, but I'm happy to report that she's still working in movies today. She is the last of the mainstream Lolitas in name put out into major pop culture, and there's a lot to be learned from her life and career trajectory so far. Dominique Swain was born in 1980 in Malibu on the side of a freeway and began to work in the industry very young. Though she maintained a fair amount of normalcy in going to school and balancing auditions as more of an extracurricular activity, at least at first. Her younger sister, Chelsea Swain, would later play one of the Lisbon sisters in Sofia Coppola's The Virgin Suicides in 1999. So the family was no stranger to a gauzy lens of the late 1990s being applied to an underage girl. Before Lolita, Dominique hadn't done much more than play the body double for Macaulay Culkin's younger sister in The Good Son in 1993. According to interviews at the time, Dominique had stopped auditioning for commercials ad nauseum almost 2 years before when she was offered the audition for Adrian Lyne's Lolita. She auditioned, got it over 2,500 other young actors, and became, as Lyne referred to her on set, my Lolita. It was her first role, and that's important. Now, I've rehashed a lot of Swain's experiences on set and in preparation for the role of Lolita in our episode on the 1997 movie. But by all accounts, she approached the role very confidently, often improvising inside of a scene. Swain seemed both full of energy and eager to please. I'll remind you of this moment inside of a 1995 chemistry test between her and Jeremy Irons.
Okay, I'm going.
Now I'm a conniving little slut.
Now, a lot of the middleman-like pop culture of the 1990s are at play here. The production required that Swain and Irons have a pillow between them in scenes where she sits on his lap. But there's photos from the set of Adrian Lyne regularly hugging and making physical contact with his lead star. Dominique Swain could not, thankfully, appear nude in the movie, but she could appear in a skin-tight sheer bodysuit from a distance as if she's nude. There was also a running controversy on set with the cast and crew on whether Dominique was being coddled too much. Other crew members seem visibly uncomfortable with the subject matter and make excuses for it as they go. My friend experienced abuse as a child and she's fine now. According to Elizabeth Kay's piece, Lolita Comes Again from 1998 in Esquire magazine, Dominique Swain was high-spirited and loved the attention that came with starring in a movie at 15. She once allegedly held up production a whole day because she didn't want her last scene to come. But shooting wraps and her performance in this movie is undeniable. While Lolita struggled through edits and couldn't find a distributor, Swain returned to Malibu High School and gets a role playing John Travolta's daughter in Face Off. You know, that famous movie where John Travolta and Nicolas Cage switch faces. Here's the setup of the scene I'm about to show you. They've just switched the faces. Travolta goes back home and immediately starts hitting on his teenage daughter, played by Dominique Swain. So in this whole scene, she is in her underwear and the camera is panning up and down her body as John Travolta leers at her.
I'll have to call you back. You're not respecting my boundaries.
I'm coming in, Janie.
Janie?
I don't think you heard me, Jamie. You've got something that I crave.
And it sounds bad, but trust me when I say it looks worse. So this part raises Swain's profile, and she gets a big boost in publicity when Lolita is finally released in the U.S. on the Showtime network in 1998. During this press tour, she speaks eloquently on the topics that the book covers, even if those topics were not necessarily translated into the movie. For a few years after Lolita was buried in the U.S., Swain appeared in a few sex-driven rom-coms. She plays the lead in Girl in 1998, about a teenager who decides she wants to be sexy alongside Portia de Rossi and Selma Blair, complete with the most 1998 thing ever, a kiss scene between Swain and Tara Reid. But within just 2 years of Lolita, she was rarely seen in a movie that didn't go straight to DVD. And in nearly all these movies, she plays a character whose storyline boils down to this. Either she is extremely sexualized from the first frame, or she's a character hell-bent on losing her virginity, or her having sex in a movie triggers a tragic event or consequence. By the mid-2000s, she was strictly in indie movies, then switched over to indie horror, where, like many before her, she gets a reputation as a scream queen that she holds on to this day. She killed it in a small role in the movie Alpha Dog from 2006, but the last decade of Swain's career has brought mostly B-movie titles. Titles like Boone the Bounty Hunter, Nazi Overlord, Eminence Hill, Nazis at the Center of the Earth, campy genre stuff that her performances are really good in, not the prestigious career that Lolita was supposed to have promised her. An echo of all the Lolitas that came before her. There's more to it than her filmography dropping off in prestige projects pretty sharply. It has a lot to do with how she was received in the media, and how the media framed her as a sexy party girl, as a little bit weird, and encouraging her to appear naked. Swain has always been very much herself. She brought her pet ferret to the American premiere of Lolita in 1998. She was known on the party scene in the early 2000s, something she expanded on in a brief interview from 2001 that calls her a reformed Hollywood party girl.
I used to be crazy and just drink too much.
The press kind of leaned into this sexualized partying image, and that's something that it's difficult to know how she felt about without actually talking to her. Swain is on social media and will do press junkets when a movie she's in is released, but she hasn't given an in-depth interview about her life in years and years. I want to share some press quotes about Swain from when she was at the height of her teenage fame. Here in a piece where Dolores Hayes is described as the 12-year-old nymphette who exchanges hand jobs for candy.
John Travolta sang to her, Jeremy Irons faked sex with her. Dominique Swain is America's least ordinary teenager.
The marketing for Lolita, as well as how often she's presented sexually in the movie, certainly did a lot to shape Swain's image. Just as Sue Lyon appearing in the heart-shaped sunglasses shaped hers, just as sucking her thumb in a crib shaped Carol Baker's career, Swain was introduced to us as a seductress, not a squeaky clean kid the way that many 15-year-olds have been. She appeared on a number of magazine covers posing suggestively as Lolita when the movie was first released. She's licking her finger on the cover of Esquire in 1998. She's looking into the camera while Jeremy Irons kisses her hand on the cover of Viva. A little later in her career, she does a few bikini covers for Him magazine when she's 20. The headline, Easy Tiger, Dominique Swain is on the loose. She then became the youngest person ever to pose naked for PETA in 2001 at the age of 21, looking over her shoulder in a classroom scene. She's written, I'd rather go naked than wear fur over and over on the blackboard, Bart Simpson style. Again, I'm not shaming her for doing this at all. What I'm trying to comment on is how the media was framing this young actor. Here's an interview she did at the time of the PETA spread.
Are people reacting to the poster?
Not really in the way that one might hope. Some of my and my boyfriend's mutual friends called, and they were like, "Oh yeah, your girlfriend's hot. How'd you get her?" Da da da. And I was like.
That's not what we were going for.
Exactly.
Okay, you know what? It's been cute talking, but let's go check out the poster, okay?
This is an interview that's available on YouTube, and the comments on these interviews, regardless of whether the interview is from 1998 or 2018, always say, Lolita, or some weird shit like this.
Ugh, yuck. The audience is so creepy, like yelling and howling at her. She is kind of flirtatious, though.
Here's another interview from 2002, where Dominique jumps into the host's arms at the beginning of the interview and describes her own personality in the context of auditioning for Lolita.
They were casting in L.A. I was like trying out for Barbie doll commercials when I was 12 years old, and it wasn't working out. I have a little bit too much enthusiasm even for commercials.
Were you doing, you're launching yourself at people at the auditions?
You know, it doesn't go over very well.
Okay.
They don't think that they have to catch you.
So. Yeah.
And then here's how she describes the parts that she was getting at this time. This being a reference to 2002's New Best Friend.
Yeah, I play this like sex-crazed 17-year-old maniac. So
pleasure seeing you again.
Here's a comment from below this video.
She is flirty, just like Lolita.
I don't know how Dominique Swain feels about this portion of her life now, but she was very much a contemporary of the teen dream squad of the 90s that I would loop in actors like Alicia Silverstone, Drew Barrymore, Jenna Malone, Rose McGowan, Tara Reid, Selma Blair, Christina Ricci, Natalie Portman, and on and on. And Dominique Swain deserved a career of that caliber. But I'm arguing here that being Lolita-fied as an introduction to public life is a massive thing to get out from underneath. So Swain continues on to be a genre film actress and continues to work today. Her co-star Jeremy Irons hasn't wanted for work since. Granted, he was an established actor when he took the role of Humbert Humbert, but consider that he has had multiple instances of saying very offensive things about women and the queer community that were barely reported on, and he's continued to work as the ultimate villain uninterrupted, most recently being nominated for his work in Watchmen. Nor did James Mason struggle to find work after Lolita in 1962. He was in control of his career to a much greater extent. He was already established. He was not being aggressively pursued by the person who decided what he was doing with his life, as happened with Lion. Donald Sutherland didn't suffer the bout of stalking and press backlash from having been in Lolita that Blanche Baker did. John Neville, who played Humbert in Lolita My Love, was never faced with the choice of exposing himself on stage or losing his job. There is always an unfair burden put on the Lolita in the equation, which is really just an extension of how our culture treats the character of Dolores Hayes. Dominique Swain, like Sue Lyon, did have a wild youth and generated the occasional exploitative TMZ headline, but neither of them were given the amount of grace that their male co-stars would have been. Anytime Swain has come up in the news for anything, good or bad, the lead is Lolita actress Dominique Swain, attaching a stigma to her name before you even know what the story is about. Yes, Lolita is Swain's most famous role, but as we know from the Long Island Lolita case, the term Lolita is generally applied to young women who we are supposed to be thinking of as devious. Going off of her performance in Lolita alone, Dominique Swain is a massively talented person, and the last Lolita did not get a fair shot. The good news is that she is well and happy, and it's not too late to give her the types of parts she's proven she could handle since she was 14. One last quick thing here. Dominique went on a show called Celebrity Ghost Stories in the 2000s, and she did give this iconic quote.
It's one thing to have a ghost. It's entirely another thing to have a ghost who hates women and may be trying to kill you.
And I'm never going to stop quoting that. That is incredible. And then after Dominique Swain, no more Lolitas. Except that's not exactly true, is it? We've talked about Millie Bobby Brown having the term applied to her just 3 years ago at the beginning of this episode. Natalie Portman had this label of playing Lolitas, the subtext being the underage fixation of adult male desires in her early roles in the 1990s. Aaliyah was treated this way at the beginning of her fame with Age Ain't Nothing But a Number. Brooke Shields was treated like a Lolita in the 70s when she was allowed to pose for Playboy naked at 10 years old. Britney Spears had the Lolita label applied to her because of how she was styled at the height of her early fame. Both Dakota and Elle Fanning have starred in Lolita-themed perfume shoots while underage, and Dakota Fanning starred in a movie where her character is brutally raped when she was 12. Shirley Temple was styled as if she were stripping for adult male stars in movies when she was under 10 years old. And let's be honest, the reason that I'm using these examples is because you know who these actors are, and their careers, if not their lives, were able to overcome the stigma applied to them. By this logic, they're the lucky ones. And that's not the norm. The Sue Lyons of the world don't get the benefit of that. So just because the fury of a new Lolita adaptation hasn't reached the mainstream in any meaningful way in nearly 25 years, doesn't mean that the story and the stigma and the cultural myth assigned to its title character, a character who never really existed, doesn't still exist. It's very much here in the way that we talk about abuse, in the way that we dismiss abuse, in communities where the story is well remembered, and in callous conversations where the term Lolita is deployed in place of child I think deserved and is to blame for the abuse they suffered. So what do we do about that? Opinions vary. The closer I've studied this work, and I've studied it very closely, I don't think the answer is to pretend that Lolita never happened and hope that the world follows suit, because it definitely won't. And I think it's almost a disservice to not attempt to face the monster that our culture has created, and that, whether we realize it or not, we have probably been complicit in at some point. So many people have avoided knowing the truth of the text because of this very flawed cultural narrative that hasn't just misled us, it has harmed people, and avoiding that reality has done nothing to combat it. Who we have yet to see, and who it is necessary that we see, is Dolores Hayes. So no, there is no Lolita curse. The lives of the four Lolitas I described to you today are all very different. Their commonalities lie in being sexualized and overblown by the media and the public, and many of them dealing with abuse before and after taking the role. This is not something exclusive to the role of Lolita. It's the story of many, many young entertainers thrust into the spotlight as a sex object without any protection. Next week is the last episode of this show, and it's going to be a lot of things. It's going to be people who I've spoken to throughout this series speaking on their thoughts on the future of Lolita. It'll be conversations with female and non-binary filmmakers I really love on what they think is missing in pop media addressing child sex abuse. It's a look at movies that have been made about child sex abuse in the last 15 years, and it's me figuring out what the fuck to do with everything we've learned here. So if you've been with me this far, thank you so much, and let's see where all this lands. Next week on Lolita Podcast. Lolita Podcast is an iHeartRadio production. It is written and hosted by me, Jamie Loftus, produced by Sophie Lichterman, Beth Ann Macaluso, Miles Gray, and Jack O'Brien. It is edited by Isaac Taylor. Music is from Zoe Blade, and our theme is from Brad Dickert. My guest voices this week are Julia Clare, Anna Hosnier, Sophie Lichterman, Daniel Goodman, Miles Gray, and Isaac Taylor. See you next week.